ending Max as just not stopping the search. As long as he kept looking for her, she was still real. "Do you sometimes feel like..." Emmanuel paused. "Like you don't even know who you are without her?" Ori watched him, not moving. "I did. When the forgetting first happened in Boston. During the wedding," he continued. A faint smile flickered. "The wedding. Those terrible tuxedos." Finally, Ori smiled too. He couldn't help it. "I remember standing there with Paul watching the broadcast. I thought, it's going to happen to us too. One of us was going to lose his shadow, and it was going to be me." His eyes searched Ori's face. "I was convinced it was going to be me. Because he was so strong, so... larger than life and sure of everything, always. I was always the one afraid or uncertain, never taking risks. Standing there in front of the TV, I couldn't imagine how I'd go on without him as just myself. I thought that meant something. A weakness." He shrugged. On the floor, his shadow did the same. "Here I am." Ori looked down again. He didn't want to agree with it, but he knew Emmanuel was right. "I have to tell you something else," Emmanuel began again at last. "I just want you to listen, that's all." He drew closer, his voice dropping. "I've heard some things over the last 2 years. Not much, but snatches here and there. It's rumor, but so many people have the same story, there must be at least some truth to it." Emmanuel was speaking faster and faster in his excitement. "They're saying... New Orleans." Ori grimaced. Emmanuel blinked in surprise. The icy rain pattered against the ground into slush outside. "You know about it too," he said at last. "I heard the same thing back in Arlington." The group of hardened travelers standing around an empty pool played in his mind like a silent film. Their leader's leathery face and shaved head. Her gun. Ursula. Had they made it after all? How many of them still had their shadows? "Well, that's what the books are for. The one who gathers. The rumors say he's gathering people, but not just people. He's looking for something else. Memories. Books have memories, right?" Emmanuel asked, staring hard at his hands. "In a way." "Books also have shadows," Ori said. Emmanuel looked up at him hopefully. "So do pieces of shit sitting out on the asphalt." "Ori," he bristled. "So do dead birds, trash cans, decrepit buildings." "Stop. I'm just saying that's a lot of risk to collect thousands of books from a crazed warrior clan and a long, dangerous way to drag them for a rumor about a bunch of jumbled nonsense." Emmanuel refused to give up. "I don't think it's just a rumor." Ori didn't look at him. He couldn't. They both knew what he was going to ask next. "Ori, it's over," Emmanuel said gently. Ori felt his hand on his shoulder. "It's been weeks since she forgot and disappeared. She's gone. She was gone a long time ago. There's no reason to stay here now." "No," Ori said. "Ori, no!" Emmanuel put his hands up and moved back a few steps as a gesture of peace. He took a long breath. In the dim light, Ori could see the outline of him against the wall grow and shrink as he did. "I know how bad the odds are," Ori said. The fire hissed. "But I just can't." He stared at the exhausted slope of Emmanuel's shoulders. "If it was the other way around, what would you want me to do for you? What if Paul was possibly still here in D.C.? What would you want me to do?" Emmanuel turned away abruptly and made a sudden sound that could have been a sob. It came from so deep inside him that Ori jerked halfway to his feet before he realized he'd even moved, arms out to catch his friend before he fell. It was the sound of pain that was too great for a mind to bear anymore. The sound of a soul dying, leaving only biological echoes behind to wander through the motions of life until the end. Ori waited for a long time, for the rest of it, for Emmanuel to collapse. But nothing followed. Nothing fell into his arms.
I would want you to tell me to give up,
Emmanuel finally said, but the words were hardly words. They were a moan. Ori looked at him as he withered in the firelight. Too far. His words had gone too far. Emmanuel's hands were still pressed against his face, blocking his expression from view. Their shadows twitched, weak in the firelight. I shouldn't have said that, Ori finally said. Emmanuel held his hand up to cut him off.
After. His voice was hard. After we get Paul's book, I'll lend you a few soldiers to look for Max. But I promised them all that if they helped me get what I need, all of them would make it to New Orleans with me. I can't go back on my word. Whatever you decide for yourself is up to you. But the soldiers will stay with you for 2 weeks, and then follow after us.
Thank you, Ori said. Emmanuel nodded. Ori thought he was going to leave, but he stayed there, head down, for a long time.
I hope you change your mind before that, he finally said. About New Orleans.
I can't, Ori said.
Can't? He asked. Or won't?
They looked at each other for a long time.
I don't want to forget, Ori said.
The expression on Emmanuel's face was the worst kind of pain.
I didn't say forget, he murmured quietly,
his voice thick with sadness.
I would never say forget.
The One Who Gathers. The first shadowless he found was called Michael. A teenager, about 19 perhaps, not that tall, and painfully skinny from weeks of starvation, with a tousle of silky dark hair and a few faint freckles on his pale, scared face. He'd been digging around in the long-emptied garbage bins in the alley behind the assisted living facility, searching for something edible. The noise was what had drawn them to him. The amnesiac, Dr. Zade, and Nurse Marie stood blocking the only way out of the narrow, dead-end street with their bodies, long before he heard them there.
Easy,
the amnesiac said when the shadowless finally turned around, then started, movement swift and compact like a cornered animal. The amnesiac glanced at Dr. Zade, who was trying to stand in a posture that both appeared as unthreatening as possible and also covered as much of the alley as possible.
Do you remember English? He continued. You understand what I'm saying?
The shadowless flinched. His hands were curled into defensive claws. The amnesiac felt the weight of the kitchen knife on his belt and its crudely fashioned plastic and duct tape scabbard. He'd practiced reaching for the handle and whipping it out several times before they went outside. He didn't want to have to be good with a blade, but he did want to be good with a blade, just in case.
You look hungry,
Dr. Zade said. The amnesiac saw recognition register in the boy's eyes. The meaning of that word, the hope.
What's your name?
The shadowless stared at them. Slowly the hands uncurled. His eyes shimmered, tears like mirrors.
I don't remember, he moaned. That's all right,
Dr. Zade smiled.
How about we give you one? Your name is Michael, he said.
Michael,
the shadowless repeated.
Michael,
he said again more fiercely, in the familiar tone the amnesiac had heard so many times, a desperation not just to cling to something, but to have something to cling to in the first place.
Michael, we're friends,
Dr. Zade continued. We're here to help you. I'm a doctor. You can call me Dr. Zade.
What kind of doctor?
A neurologist, he said, not expecting the term to mean anything anymore to Michael. The amnesiac could see from his expression that it didn't.
I work on the brain, He pointed to the side of his head at his temple. My specialty is memories. The word hung in the air between all of them like a physical thing. Memories. The amnesiac watched Michael take a step toward them, as if to move into the aura of those lingering syllables.
You can make me remember?
He asked with terrifying desperation. No, the amnesiac wanted to say. How much had Michael forgotten, he wondered. What magic had he already done?
We can try, he said instead.
Michael settled in, and the amnesiac began teaching him the same Alzheimer's memory exercises Dr. Zade had taught him when he'd first arrived. It was mostly useless, but they had to start somewhere. There was a process, a scientific process, Dr. Zade insisted, as he tried to finish his experimental treatment plan. If they were going to find the cure, they had to do it right. They needed patience, and they needed a process.
We don't even know the cause of shadowlessness, the amnesiac had argued. How can you develop a treatment plan if we don't even know the cause?
That's what will make us fail right there, Dr. Zade said. He pointed at him. The amnesiac stared back, confused.
What?
He finally asked.
Doubt,
Dr. Zade replied. The amnesiac wasn't sure what he believed, but he put that aside. He didn't argue against the doctor's plan after that. He did everything he was asked, everything he could to keep the patient safe. New Orleans had been shadowless for almost a month by then. Once the forgetting reached the city limits, he had helped Dr. Zade remove all the signs on their facility. The metal address numbers on the front wall, Dr. Zade's name plaque by the door, the information board that was posted on the roof. Anything that would tell someone who still remembered how to read that a doctor could be inside, that there might be medicine or food as well. They added locks to doors and boarded up windows. Now the assisted living facility looked no different from the rest of the ruined structures that surrounded it. Once they were confident the building was secure and inconspicuous, Dr. Zade, the amnesiac, and Nurse Marie sneaked out a few more times to look for more shadowless to admit to the assisted living facility, growing bolder, going farther into the city each time. Some listened, some ran. When they started taking Michael with them, always holding Nurse Marie's hand so he didn't wander off, they became much better at persuading other shadowless to trust them. The amnesiac started bringing food when they went out looking, both as a gesture of good faith and as a way to stop the shadowless from fleeing immediately before any of them could get a full sentence out. Even when the power went down across New Orleans and the riots broke out, Dr. Zade refused to give up. Even when the police finally left their posts around the city one by one, and bodies in the streets, shadowed and shadowless alike, became more and more common, he pressed on.
How many more patients do we need?
The amnesiac asked him one night, after they'd rationed out dinner for everyone.
As many as we can find, he said. But I'd settle for at least 8. That's enough for 2 groups, including our own people. One variable, one control. Then we'll start getting somewhere.
The amnesiac looked down at the binder in his hands, the copy of the one Hemu Joshi's doctor had given him, at the list of names he had added as the very first page. Everyone inside the assisted living facility. 10 nurses, 1 doctor, 10 Alzheimer's patients, 1 case of total retrograde amnesia due to vehicular trauma, and the 3 newcomers they'd found, including Michael. Next to the names of all 3 of the new people, 2 of the Alzheimer's patients, and 1 of the nurses, the amnesiac had drawn stars. Shadowless, the symbol meant. Shadowless, but still alive. India News Incorporated, INI, reporter.
And you are?
Elizabeth Herrera. Catholic, born and raised. The amnesiac scooted the list of names over farther so he could see the page beneath. It was one he knew well, an excerpt of a decades-old interview with the American biologist, the one with the prosthetic leg, who had taught Gajarajan's elephant sister to paint.
I. Which you offer as proof that you've never met the elephant, Gajarajan Guru Vayur Kesavan.
Herrera. Guru Vayur Temple's rules are very clear. Only Hindus are allowed inside the gates. I did try, though, when the story about Gajarajan first broke. I called and explained who I was. I got halfway through my speech before it clicked. Immediately, they were all yelling. They called for the head priest. And still, I couldn't get in.
I. What happened after that?
Herrera. All bad ideas, none of which worked either. I tried to bribe them. I tried to reach someone in government to help. I even briefly considered trying to break in. I just wanted proof. To be told something like that had happened, that I'd successfully taught painting for the first time in history to a wild elephant born in 1998, some 20 years after her elder brother had been captured and permanently stationed at the temple. And then, a few days before my research rotation in India was over, the elder brother spontaneously painted a picture of me?
I. It is uncanny.
Herrera. That's a word for it. I have another one. Magic.
I. It's hard to disagree.
Herrera. Well, what happened next was even more uncanny. After I finally threw in the towel, I had only about a week left at Tiruvananthapuram before my research visa was up, and I had to return to the United States. I hardly had time to finish the work I had left, but on the last day, I blocked off an hour to go see Manikam, to say goodbye. That's her name, the one I taught to paint, the much younger sister of Gajarajan.
I. That must have been hard.
Herrera. It was, but it's always that way. There are only so many elephants left in the world, you know. To get the data you need, the sample size you need, you're always traveling between sanctuaries. India, Thailand, Tennessee.
I. Go on.
Herrera. I was with her, alone in the main pasture. Well, she started making the motions she always made when she wanted to paint. It's a specific trunk movement and the ears flapping in a certain way. I had learned to recognize it. I took out her easel and canvas and paints and set them up for her. Sometimes Manikam knew what she wanted to paint, sometimes she didn't. But this was one of those times she did. It was like she'd gotten an image in her head and had just been waiting for me to get there so I could help her set up the easel and paints.
I. Did she paint?
Herrera. She did. Immediately. Normally, it's a slow process. She sometimes had trouble holding the brush with her trunk. She'd lose her grip on it, drop it. But this time, she jammed the bristles into the paints on her big palette almost before I'd finished preparing it. She worked desperately. That's the word I'd use. When she finished, it was all at once. Usually, it was hard for me to tell when she was really done because she'd dawdle, and I'd go to remove the canvas and she'd get upset. But this time, it was a fury of color. Then suddenly it was over. She stepped back and stared at me as if inviting me to look.
I. What did you see?
Herrera. I didn't know at first. It was so detailed. I thought it was a pattern of some kind, sort of geometric and repeating. It was.
I. I don't understand.
Herrera. I didn't either. But that evening, one of the interns came into the main lab. I had the easel sitting by my desk so the canvas could continue drying. She took one look at it and asked me if Manikam had done it. Why? I asked. She said it was because it reminded her of the painted walls of the temple her mother used to take her to when she was growing up. One county over, in the town of Guru Vayur.
I. No.
Herrera. I didn't believe it either. I printed a scanned copy and mailed it to them.
I. And was it?
Herrera. Yes. It was an exact replica of the pattern of the northern wall of Gajarajan's residential enclosure. Down to the centimeter.
Smiles. I. It's not. It's not.
Herrera. I know.
I.
After a long pause.
What happened then?
Herrera. I left. I had to. My research visa was up.
I. That must have been hard.
Herrera. But it was okay, you know? Now, I don't really care what anyone else thinks. I'm not a neurologist, but to me, that proved it. It proved that the stories about Gajarajan were true, that elephants really could remember things they hadn't experienced directly, but others had, that they could... I don't know.
I. Please.
Herrera. Like memories are something we somehow can move or share. Maybe not even all of them, but at least one. One memory. One thing that always stays across time and space.
The amnesiac looked up from the binder at Dr. Zade. You really think we're going to find a cure? He asked. Dr. Zade was silent for so long, the amnesiac thought he might not answer, because the answer was no, and he didn't want to lie.
We have to,
he finally said instead. They went out every other day, looking for food and supplies in the mornings, and shadowless in the afternoons. Something was happening, but it was hard to tell what. There were signs of human life left behind. Things changed places, scavenged morsels among the wreckage appeared or went missing. But the humans themselves, living ones, were becoming harder and harder to find. There was more dried blood in the corners of places than there had been before. Twice they actually did glimpse other shadowed survivors, but they weren't the sort of survivors the amnesiac wanted to meet. The first group was traveling in a set of three, and the second in a pair. All men, all wearing makeshift gear that looked as though it was for fighting, all well-armed. Dr. Zade's little team waited inside alleys and broken buildings until the others passed both times. They didn't know what the men were looking for, but they didn't want to find out. They managed to find four more shadowless over the next few weeks. The first two had each forgotten so much they were barely wary at all. The third was far more afraid. She was running, clothes soaked through with sweat. She must have been going for miles. You're safe now, Dr. Zade kept repeating to her, begging her to come out from the abandoned house she'd thrown herself into when she saw them coming from the other direction. The amnesiac started tossing the food in the open window through which she'd crawled. They'd never been so deep into the downtown before. We just want to help. I'm a doctor, Dr. Zade continued. Finally, it was the shadowless Michael who convinced her.
My name is Letty,
she said softly as she walked with them back toward the assisted living facility on the other side of town.
What were you running from? Nurse Marie asked her. Exterminators, she said.
Exterminators? The amnesiac asked. Beside him he saw Michael shudder.
You know them too.
Dr. Zade had noticed the same thing.
I thought that's what all of you were when you first found me, Michael said.
He shrugged helplessly.
Now I don't remember. I just remember that they're bad.
Ones with shadows who kill ones without,
Letty continued.
It seemed like she couldn't speak above a whisper. They go around looking for us.
Why? Dr. Zade asked, voice stony. Letty shook her head.
Money or food?
She paused.
They also enjoy it, I think.
The amnesiac shook his head in disgust. Who's paying them? He asked at last.
Whoever's inside the city hall. Someone's still trying to run things, trying to clean up New Orleans before too many shadowless.
She stopped abruptly, mouth snapped shut, and stared in terror at them all. Magic.
Hamu's frightened voice came back to the amnesiac.
The pleading expression in the young man's exhausted, terrified eyes.
It's all right, Dr. Zade said to her. We know about the pull.
Letty's eyes darted to the amnesiac's. We do, he said. It's real.
The Mandai spice market in Pune flashed in his mind, or rather the memory of it, because it didn't exist anymore.
We've seen it happen.
The fourth shadowless they met because of Letty. They also met their first exterminators.
She was, I don't know, but I know we were together before we forgot why, so she has to be someone important.
Letty said to the amnesiac as they all crept across Lafayette Square. They were deep into the central business district, just south of the French Quarter, looking for a street they hoped Letty would still find familiar. It was far past their usual search boundaries, but Dr. Zadeh was getting desperate. The shadowless had been disappearing like ghosts. There were so few left now, and those they did see ran well before anyone could get close enough, even Michael. If this shadowless still remembered Letty even a little, there stood a chance of convincing her to come with them. The neighborhood clearly unnerved Letty, every sound and creak of wood pricking like a needle on a fresh new spot of skin. The amnesiac looked around nervously, her fear making him jumpy. Here he didn't know the angles to hide in, the directions to run that weren't dead ends. They wound their way deeper in. The shadowless they sought was still alive, hiding between two empty buildings, almost exactly where Letty had said she lost her when she'd started running so many days ago.
"You're alive,"
Letty gasped when she finally saw her. The shadowless looked up from where she was crouched between a few dumpsters. The amnesiac saw the flash of recognition in her eyes. She remembered Letty still.
"Shh,"
she hissed. The amnesiac and the others didn't move for a second, but Letty darted behind another of the dumpsters immediately.
"Hide,"
she said. She mouthed the word, "Exterminators." They all threw themselves down behind piles of concrete, burned-out furniture, any shape that would hide them as the footsteps echoed closer. But it was too late. The exterminators had already seen them.
"Look at this," the one covered in scars said to the other, probably the tallest man the amnesiac had ever seen in person. He took the gun out of his holster. "Newbies, you all know you're in Jackson's neighborhood, right?"
"Jackson's neighborhood."
The tall one looked at the scarred one with his eyes narrowed.
"I've had it with this. People crawling out of the woodwork, muscling in on our area."
He pointed the gun straight at the amnesiac, and Dr. Zadeh and Nurse Marie shrieked, shouting pleading things that interrupted each other and made no sense.
"You can't just come in here and take our catch. That isn't how it works."
"I'm sorry,"
the amnesiac said shakily.
"We didn't know."
"Yeah, right,"
the tall one sneered.
"Explain that, then."
His gun moved to aim casually at Letty and the other shadowless, causing them to cower to the ground, whimpering.
"Family!" the amnesiac cried. "They lost their shadows a week ago. We're all family. We're just looking for food."
"Food here in this neighborhood also belongs to Jackson,"
the scarred one said. "But more importantly, so does your family now."
"No,"
Dr. Zadeh said.
"Once they lose their shadows, they're ours."
"What about when you lose yours?"
Dr. Zadeh asked the scarred exterminator. The tall one tipped his head at his partner.
"Then I'll shoot him immediately and collect my reward for it."
"Or the other way around,"
the scarred one added, grinning.
"Please, we'll leave. We'll never come back,"
the amnesiac promised.
"No can do,"
the scarred exterminator said. He stepped closer.
"See, even if I did believe you that these two were your family, they're still shadowless, and you're still in our hunting neighborhood."
The grin dropped off his face.
"But I don't believe you anyway."
"Shadowless are almost gone or hiding,"
the tall one said.
"Other guys have been crowding our territory for months now, taking our kills. We've heard every story there is, twice, including yours. I'm putting a stop to it."
"Please,"
Dr. Zadeh started to say, just as something cruised soundlessly through the air overhead. The only way any of them knew it had been there at all was the huge dark square it cast down over them as it passed. In the same instant, Letty's shadowless friend and the two exterminators dropped into tight crouches covering their heads. It wasn't just an instinctual flinch to some nearby movement, the amnesiac realized with a chill. It was a deliberate, practiced move.
What was that? The amnesiac gasped.
Come on, the scarred exterminator said to the tall one, already running away.
The shadowless, he replied angrily.
But the scarred one was already halfway down the street.
No time, I'm not dying today.
A gust of wind made everyone jump again, and the shadowless whimpered in terror, sinking even lower to the ground.
We have to go, man,
the scarred one yelled.
Jackson, come on!
Your lucky day,
the tall exterminator snarled at them. He pointed a finger straight at Dr. Zade's chest.
We catch you leaning in on our business again, it'll be the last time.
Dr. Zade refused to answer.
We hear,
the amnesiac said.
Don't forget now,
he teased, sinister, nodding his chin at their still-there shadows. Then he bolted after his friend, eyes checking the sky. As soon as the exterminators disappeared around the corner, everyone gasped, suddenly remembering to breathe again.
What was that thing?
Nurse Marie cried and tried to grab both the amnesiac and Dr. Zade, but they had each moved out of her reach at the same moment to look up. They spun around, trying to see the sky between the buildings, but the roofs were too close together, their view of the sky too narrow. Letty ran to the shadowless she knew, Michael close behind her.
Was it a plane?
Dr. Zade yelled.
Was it a plane?
Letty's friend was shaking now. She seemed to shrink down onto the asphalt of the alley.
Hey,
the amnesiac crouched so as to be on her same level.
Do you know what that was?
The shadowless's eyes stared straight through him, unblinking.
It's coming back,
she trembled. The amnesiac turned back to look at Dr. Zade, who was still staring into the sky.
What is it? What's coming back?
He asked. But she was too terrified to answer.
If it was a plane, if someone is still flying a plane,
Dr. Zade continued excitedly,
we have to get their attention.
Wait,
the amnesiac said to Letty. Keep hold of her. He ran for a utility ladder welded to the side of a building to climb up to the roof.
Be careful,
Nurse Marie cried, watching him ascend with a concerned expression on her face.
Keep away from the edge. You can't judge depth with one eye.
She'd been the first nurse the amnesiac had depended upon when he arrived at the assisted living facility, when he was barely strong enough for crutches, and she still worried after him as if he was still her charge.
Almost there, the amnesiac yelled to her.
He hauled himself onto the flat top of the building. Dusk was falling, smearing everything with an orangey-purple haze. On the horizon, so far it looked to be over the western area of Metairie, a dark thing rippled in the sky.
I can't see,
he started to say, and then he heard the screams. Nurse Marie was at Dr. Zade's side by the time the amnesiac had scrambled back to the edge of the roof to peer down at them, clutching a trembling Michael to her with knuckles that had gone white. Letty cowered with her companion.
What did you see?
Dr. Zade asked softly. The dark shape passed overhead again. It was the size of a small house, with angles as sharp as blades. There were more screams from the direction in which it had gone.
Jesus Christ,
Nurse Marie said. Dr. Zade took the new shadowless's face in his hands and made her look at him.
What is it?
He asked firmly, in the voice he had mastered over decades of practice, a tone of absolute authority that could cut through fear or pain, or even sometimes the terrified fog of an Alzheimer's episode, and could compel any patient to answer him.
What is it?
The shadowless's eyes finally focused on Dr. Zade.
Death kite,
she whispered. From his vantage point above them, the amnesiac saw the shape lean into the wind to return toward them once more.
We have to get inside, he breathed. Right now.
Later, after they'd gotten Letty and her friend they had named Joe back to the facility,
The amnesiac remembered that Hemu had once told him it was customary to fly celebratory kites on Zero Shadow Day. After everyone had their fun with the moment of shadowlessness and the shadows had returned, the afternoon would turn toward food and games. Little boys loved that part most of all, the kite flying, or rather, the kite fighting. The object of the game was to be the last one still aloft. In their desperation to win, the boys often rubbed the strings with powdered glass so they could saw through one another's lines as the fabric sheets crossed, and later even cheated by adding hidden blades to the edges of the frames to cut the bodies of other kites. At the time, the amnesiac thought he would have liked to have seen a kite fight if it had been possible. In a way, he'd gotten his wish. Was it Hemu? He often wondered each time over the months that followed that he watched the death kite circle overhead. Wonderful things that had been twisted into something horrible and evil by accident. Was it Hemu, or had it been someone else?
Nurse Marie?
Vivi's voice came from the dimly glowing hallway. She, the amnesiac, and Dr. Zade turned to see the old woman leaning nervously into the room. Candles were in each corner, but since they'd boarded up all the windows for safety against the riots, it always looked no brighter than dusk at all times. In the weak light, Vivi looked even frailer than by day.
You'd better come.
What is it, dear? Nurse Marie asked, rising to her feet. The knee was giving her trouble again, the amnesiac saw. Everyone's all right.
We're all right, Vivi said.
There was a long pause. Beside him, the amnesiac heard Dr. Zade sigh, exhausted. Vivi looked down.
It happened again, to Edith.
They were short only one more shadowless when a second pair of exterminators found them. Dr. Zade was in the middle of handing food they'd brought to the tiny ball of rags shivering against the concrete wall, and Michael and Letty were calling quietly to it. The amnesiac never saw if it was a man or a woman, old or young. The shadowless was about to reach for the food, just one withered hand and two narrowed eyes visible from the folds of dirty fabric. But then in a swirl of layers, it was gone.
What the...
Dr. Zade gasped in frustration.
What the indeed?
A low voice said from behind them.
I'd ask you the same question about what the fuck you're doing here.
They all turned at once, hearts stuttering. The amnesiac's skin went cold and clammy. There were two figures there, a man and woman dressed in old police riot gear. Exterminators.
Looks like they were after that one that just got away,
the woman replied to her partner. Her eyes landed coldly back on Dr. Zade.
This isn't what it looks like, he began.
They tried to explain. Their experiments, their hope to discover a cure. The amnesiac could see in their eyes that they didn't care. To them, there was no difference between Dr. Zade killing a shadowless in their territory or saving one. In either case, it was a body taken away for which they didn't get paid. Dr. Zade shouted for Michael and Letty to run then, as far as they could, as fast as they could. He knew that no matter how it ended up, the two of them would never be allowed to live. They were worth too much to the exterminators. Shots went off as they sprinted, deafening booms. The amnesiac couldn't look, but as he cowered in front of the exterminators and their guns, hands spread protectively in front of his face, he didn't hear either of them fall.
Please!
Nurse Marie was on her knees, begging for Dr. Zade's life.
Please!
But there was nothing they could offer that the exterminators wanted. They killed him. Manas Amadi. Smith Trace, the soldier who was stabbed during the last attempt to trade, didn't develop a fever, but the general wouldn't know if he was out of the woods for at least another week. Nuz was just so relieved that he hadn't died on the first night, when he'd been so pale from blood loss his lips were almost blue, teeth chattering, unable to keep warm,
despite all the blankets she took from her own bed and all the other beds of the soldiers under her command. They'd lost so many people recently, both to death and to the forgetting. A few days ago, she even saw a new Red that she'd once known the year before. He'd fought in the army before he lost his shadow and forgot he had. He'd been one of her best scouts, just like Trace was now. Both of them as brave and reckless as she'd ever seen. Both of them almost lost completing missions she'd ordered. Nuz didn't know if she'd be able to bear it if another person from her team died. But even though it seemed like Trace would survive, it still left the problem of who was going to take his place in her formation until he was healed. The army was stretched thin, but she'd been making do already missing her first scout. Now that she was missing two, there was no way around it.
"Go on, leave me behind," Ori wheezed from the dirt. "Save yourself."
Malik's daughter, Vienna, grunted and threw his arm over her shoulder to try to lift him.
"Save yourself," he wailed as dramatically as he could.
"Vienna,"
Nuz snapped as the girl began to laugh.
"This is not a game."
"Amadi, come on," Ori said, sitting up and dusting off his pants.
"You won't think it's a game when a Red bashes your head in because you joked your way through Malik's boot camp curriculum,"
Nuz said to him.
"And you,"
she looked hard at Vienna,
"you won't think it's a game when I don't clear you for missions."
"No, I'm sorry,"
Vienna cried. She snapped to attention and saluted. Nuz pinched her lips tight to keep the sadness from showing in her face. It was so hard to tell anyone's true age anymore. The starvation, the scars, the strain of carrying memories alone that should have been shared between others. Sometimes she didn't remember that Vienna couldn't be more than 16, maybe 17. In some ways, she seemed years older, almost the same age as Rojan. Sometimes she seemed so much like Rojan it hurt.
"I'm ready to go again, ma'am."
Nuz looked away. Vienna was not her sister, she told herself yet again. Her sister had almost made it, but the fever from the arrow wound infection took her in the end. Vienna was not her sister. It never worked.
"And how about you?"
she asked Ori. "Finish screwing around?"
"You know," Ori said as he squared off against Vienna once more, "if I didn't know any better, I'd think you didn't like me very much."
"I think you're too sensitive," she said.
"Again!"
She watched them train expressionlessly, drilling even harder. When she at last let them go, Ori gave her a wide berth and didn't speak to her for the rest of the evening. He clearly didn't believe her when she'd brushed off his remark that she didn't like him. But it was true. It wasn't that Nuz didn't like him. It was in fact the opposite. She did like him, because he was someone who was as close to the general and Paul as she was, but especially Paul. After all the stories Nuz had heard him tell about his lost best friend Ori, and now having Ori here, looking and acting exactly like she'd imagined from Paul's descriptions, telling the same stories about Paul from his own perspective, it made her feel like she too had known Ori for a long time, like he'd also been her friend, and she'd also left him behind on that mountain. When Ori had first walked through the front door with Malik, the general told him that he and Paul had tried to go back and find him and his wife Max. That was true. But what the general never told Ori was that once they'd established the army and had the forces to spare, they had planned to go back for them again, a second time. The general hadn't mentioned that second attempt, because he didn't like to talk about anything that touched the memory of Paul's last days in any way. Any reminder was too painful to him. Nuz was glad Ori didn't know, though. It made things simpler. Because she was the person who was supposed to have led the rescue team to travel to that deserted mountain, to find this Orlando Jong and Maxine Renner, and bring them safely to the Iowa. They'd trained for weeks to prepare. It was to be a small team, just a handful of soldiers and Nuz,
so that they could move quickly and quietly. Paul and the general had reported that when they'd attempted to cross back themselves, the bridge had been swarmed with shadowless and too dangerous to cross. But it was still standing, and they had greater numbers now. They could make it this time. Paul had ordered Malik to put his best people on the job, but Malik insisted he would only accept volunteers. When Nuz saw the desperation in Paul's face as he waited for someone, anyone, to raise a hand, it made her think of the first time she'd met him. She knew how easily he could have left her and Rojan there to die after the Shadowless attack, instead of helping them. They were total strangers, and he already had so many mouths to feed at the Iowa. For all he knew, they could have been feigning the seriousness of their injuries. The smarter, safer thing would have been to refuse to take them in. If it had been Nuz who had found Paul instead of the other way around, she would have run without even so much as an apology. But Paul didn't. He had looked at Nuz and her sister and known right away. Even though they were so bundled in rags, one could barely see their same dark eyes, their same sharp noses. When Malik disagreed about bringing them back to the Iowa, Paul had said, "Look at them, Malik. Just look. They're family." And he saved Rojan for what little time she'd had left. Now it was all reversed. Everyone gathered was staring at Paul this time, rather than at Nuz, and he was the one who was trying and failing to save the life of someone he loved. Nuz put her hand up firmly. She was the first volunteer. But they never went. The night before the mission was to leave, Malik had to cancel the rescue, because Paul's shadow disappeared.
"I can't justify letting you go now," Malik told her the morning after it happened. They were outside the general in Paul's room, where Malik had been standing guard since the previous evening. Inside, the sobs had grown hoarse with exhaustion. Nuz could hear Paul's voice, calm and muffled through the door, but the general was inconsolable.
"I'm afraid to leave them in case Paul..." He sighed. "I need someone to lead the library trips in my place until the general comes around again."
But the general didn't come around. As Paul deteriorated, the grief overwhelmed him. Malik tried to manage him, and Nuz tried to manage the army. Just before he'd lost his shadow, Paul had been particularly taken with the New Orleans rumors, and then with the idea that books could be what the one who gathers was seeking. Malik ordered Nuz to continue collecting as many as they could, as fast as they could. At that time, the Reds didn't exist yet. They would come later. But at that point, the library was completely abandoned, just books and cobwebs. Once or twice, they ran into a shadowless or two inside, but they weren't organized, just wanderers who had happened upon a dry, warm place, sort of like the Iowans. With Nuz in charge, they managed a few good runs before things got much worse with Paul. The last thing he said to her was about Ori.
"Find him," he begged.
Nuz promised tearfully that she'd do it, even though she knew that she never would now. The next day, Paul no longer remembered how to speak. After that, the general grew afraid that Paul would run away and get lost, so they started locking him in rooms on the upper levels. They had to move him to a different one every day because he destroyed them trying to get out. Nuz knew that the Shadowless forgot, and it was terrifying. But it was the first time she really saw up close what happened when a person lost his shadow. Paul had started to become something else. She'd never believed what had happened was anything other than fantastical, inexplicable, because there was simply no other way to make it make sense. But those last days with the man she once knew proved it beyond a doubt for her. In his fear, Paul did things no human could do. He scorched walls, turned stone bricks into ice ones, weakened hallways until they were so thin they fluttered like they were made of paper in a strong wind. Other corridors branched off into insane, infinite mazes. "That's Paul," the general would joke deliriously every morning, after they'd managed to get him out of one room and locked into the next. "Stubborn to the end."
Nuz tried to laugh out of sympathy, but nothing ever came out. It had been anything but funny trying to move Paul each morning, trying to put him in a new room without him hurting someone or escaping. But none of them could muster the courage to beg the general to order him put out of his misery before it was too late. Paul was going to kill them all, and they didn't know how to stop it. In the end, they didn't have to. Nuz didn't know how the general got Paul out of his room that night, or down the stairs and through the front door without any of them hearing. Maybe Paul still remembered him just enough. Malik and Nuz found the general in his room the next morning, his clothes and hands covered in crusted streaks of blood. They didn't ask him how he'd done it. It was too much. It was Malik who finally spoke to the general days later. He asked him for Paul's book, the copy from the wedding he and Paul had brought with them when they left Elk Cliffs. The army wanted to add it to the collection, with his permission, as a kind of memorial to Paul.
I couldn't save it, was all he'd said, and almost a whisper, his eyes locked in a 1,000-yard stare.
Nuz never found out what that meant. She thought of the book often after that, almost every day. But once Ori came, she realized she'd just been thinking of the concept of the book, not the actual words inside. The way it had looked when she'd seen it around the Iowa during better times. The slim spine, the soft cream pages, the deep navy cover with a golden sun emblazoned across it. It was sort of the way she'd always felt about Ori and Max. Just concepts. Except suddenly, Ori was right there with them. Ori, but not Max. The general, but not Paul. A few weeks after the general had saved them from his husband, they all stopped grieving long enough to remember that there might be another copy of Paul's book in the library they had recently begun to loot. But by the time they'd pulled themselves together to go again, the Reds were there. And that was why Nuz had kept her distance from Ori. She was afraid that if he knew the story, he might blame her for Max's disappearance. Nuz knew it wasn't fair, but she believed it was her fault anyway. If only she had gone to the mountain sooner, both he and Max would be at the Iowa now. The same way that if only she had gone back to the library sooner, they might have the book they now were all so desperately hoping to save.
Ursula climbed down from the driver's seat and closed the door softly behind her. It was far too early in the day to stop, and we hadn't scouted the area to make sure we were alone, but it was a worse idea to keep going. Now that I've forgotten how to read, we have to figure something out fast, before we get lost.
Duho, Intisar, you're on watch. Ys and Lucius, take Wes and Victor and see if there's any firewood nearby. Everyone stays within sight of the RV at all times, she said.
Her grip on her hunting rifle was more fierce than usual, as if she was drawing strength from it. Ori, it was the first time I've ever seen the look of weightlessness in her that I see in the other shadowless in our caravan. Zachary touched her shoulder. Maybe he saw it too.
You're with us, Ursula said to him.
Zachary collected his tools from the RV. He could tell we wanted him to draw something. Some kind of a sign we could understand without having to read. On the grass, he laid out his paints and brushes so we could see the colors. If we just stay on the huge road we've been following so far, I tried to explain to him, using words and gestures, we'll end up in New Orleans. I had no idea how he could do it, but that's what I wanted his picture, whatever wordless map he could make us, to mean. That we had to keep going south, and we had to stay on the widest, biggest road. And then at the end, there would be a huge city. At least we hoped there would be. Large enough or loud enough to catch our attention as we passed, since we wouldn't understand the road signs. Otherwise, what would be the point of stopping anyway then? If there really wasn't anything in New Orleans, it wouldn't matter if we missed it. Any other place would be just as good. Zachary nodded slowly. He, Ursula, and I took a few steps back from the RV, to take in the big black strokes of paint covering its side while he tried to figure out something to do. It was one thing to draw each of us, like Zachary often did. But how was he going not only to draw a city, but also to convey that we were supposed to head for it and in which direction it was? Zachary suddenly walked toward the RV, one eye closed, as if measuring something against its surface. "Ursula," I said. "He knows what to do." Ursula looked up from her thoughts to see Zachary touching the aluminum siding gently, examining it. When he pulled his hand away, I saw that there was a streak of color where his fingers had been, even though he had yet to touch his paints. "Did you see?" I started to ask her. "Yes," she said softly. "It's been happening for a long time." Wes is taller, but Victor is bigger. We hoisted Zachary onto his shoulders. Isabel stood next to them, holding up his art supplies with her hands so he could reach them.
"You okay to hold him?"
Ursula asked.
"Yep,"
Victor said. The lion tattoo on his bicep bulged.
"He barely weighs anything at all."
It took Zachary the rest of the afternoon to sketch his plan onto the RV. Tomorrow he'll paint it. As soon as he finished, he laid down in the center of the floor of the cabin, exhausted, and fell deep into unconsciousness the instant his eyes closed. I was the opposite. I don't think I slept at all once it got dark, even though it wasn't my turn to keep watch. I couldn't even lay inside the RV. Lucius gave me a surprised, amused look when I climbed out around 2 a.m. and went over to the place where he was standing watch for his shift. But he didn't say anything. He stared into the dark, distant trees, scanning for movement, and I looked at the RV. "Please let this work," I thought. It was too dark to see what Zachary's faint marks outlined once the sun went down. But I sat next to Lucius's spare coat on the grass and stared at the dim shape of the RV anyway until the sky began to brighten again. In the morning, I tried to puzzle out what Zachary had drawn, but the pencil lines were thin, and the indentations in the aluminum siding distorted everything. Maybe not even everything had been drawn yet. They might just have been guiding lines for his paintbrush. From around the back of the RV, Ursula, Duho, and Zachary walked slowly, carrying the cans of paint they'd brought when they left Arlington. I watched them as they approached, feeling strange. Almost like I've known them as long as I've known you, Ori. How long have we been on the road now? How long has it been since I left you? It feels like just yesterday that I walked away from the shelter, but I know that can't be true. I know I've already forgotten some things. The reading proves that. How many days between now and the last time I saw you have I also lost?
Rough night,
Ursula asked when she saw my expression. Can't remember, I joked. Duho laughed, and even Ursula tried to smile, but then her face was serious again. This will work, she said. She set the paint down and wiped her hands.
It has to.
I nodded, trying to believe her. After Zachary mixed his paints and handed Isabel the right brushes to hold up to him, he turned around from atop Victor's shoulders and looked at Ursula. His hand hovered in the air, waiting.
All right, everyone, she said. Let's let him work in peace.
We all crept around the other side of the RV to wait. Lucius napped in the shade, catching up after his shift as lookout. He still had the rope tether on his ankle, the one that whoever is watching wears so if he forgets and begins to wander off, the tether will hopefully show him that he wants to stay, not go. I settled with my back against a tree, relaxing into the cool, rough bark, and Duho and Intisar sat cross-legged in the grass farther away, talking softly to each other. I thought I saw another rose in Duho's hands at one point, but when I looked again, nothing was there. Ursula patrolled slowly, surveying the distance for movement. I heard the scrape of something soft squeezing through leaves and leaned around the trunk of my tree to look. A small, skinny wolf cocked its head and peered at me. Its yellow eyes glinted, almost glowing. We stared each other down for several seconds, perfectly still. "There are too many of us to attack me," I finally warned.
"I know,"
it said simply. "All right, then." I settled back against the tree. We both watched the RV. In the small space between the ground and the bottom of